This conference went to great expense to bring this young lady from Detroit, Michigan. Kathy?
Thank you. I got it right here on my name tag. My name is Kathy Gia, and I'm absolutely, positively, not a shadow of a doubt left in my mind, an alcoholic. Okay. Can you hear me? All right. Them selling coffee. Can you hear me? Thanks, Pokey. He said a lot of what I was going to. My path wasn't quite as similar, but similar. First of all, I want to start with thanking you for inviting me to do this, I think. I would say normally it's a cheap thrill, but I'm not from Sacramento. But it's thrilling. God. I think it would take as much time as I have here to feel relaxed and then be able to really open up. 10 minutes is short. It was a long time getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, which has saved my life. So I thank you all for that. Bill and Bob were quite amazing gentlemen, and I'm sure I would have gotten along with both of them, no doubt. I'm a potential drug addict also, so I cannot use any mind-alternating chemical. Asking to be asked to do something like this can be mind-alternating. If my body would work out like my mind, I'd look like Cher. Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. That was good. Thank you. There's another cheap thrill. I love it. Whew. That's true. The mental gymnastics I put myself through sometimes daily boggles me. It can be awesome like this room, and I, too, would prefer to be back there. I'm very willing to do this. I'm just not ready. Right now I'm looking for my ticket. I haven't stolen anything in a long time, too, but I thought about stealing one of the pillows from the room today. And that's what's real nice about AA. We can think anything we want. It's the action, you know, that I've got to definitely curb. And I have my behavior. I've done a 180-degree turnaround with my life thanks to this program, boy. And it took me 3 rehabilitation centers, a whole lot of jails before that, to even take a look at maybe I have a problem with drinking, and it's not all you people. In the beginning, I used to say, it's not me, it's my mother, my mother. I was raised by my mother's emotions. She was a heavy drinker for 35 years, and so I was emotionally disturbed before I even picked up the first drink, you know, and I believe I was born. I didn't have a chance. Jeez, I was drunk in the womb. I've got a younger brother who's a priest, and we're all convinced he was drinking Christian Brothers during that pregnancy. I don't know if y'all served that out on the West Coast, but it's a nice brandy. Do they make it here? Oh, my God. They make it here. Well, I'm sure if she was here, she would say, thank you. I liked it all. I had a real love affair going with alcohol and drugs, especially the speed, y'all, because that allowed me to drink my drug of choice longer. And the combo excited me. You know, my whole life was, you know, up, down, up, down. And then when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and put everything down to get what you people had, you told me how to put the plug in the jug and give up my drugs. Because for the first 6 months or so, you know, I came, had like 6 beers and then went to AA. And that was progress. And even in that alcoholic fog, you know, I was catching something. And then AA, I'm sorry to say, was just not enough. You know, I needed to be away, put away. And that worked for a while in the first place. And then they asked me to take that scary fourth step, and I was just not ready to look at who I had been running from for 15 years, you know. So I kind of took a fourth step. I wrote a whole lot of crap down, and then I went down to share that and found I couldn't and ended up taking a fifth of liquor instead of a fifth step after my first fourth. But it was still getting better. You know, I think a lot of us come in here and we go from suicide to homicide, and that's progress. I never want to be on his bad side. You know, I'll never reject you, Pokey. Oh, my God. I was sitting over here originally, and then they moved me over there because they must have known we would have chit-chatted, you know. I like this gentleman. I've had, you know, some time to spend with him. And I was even willing to give him my 10 minutes. So... He's a queen. I believed that man the other day when he said he had a list of 23 words that he could not use. And I'm, as I sat back there, I said, oh, fuck, I'll never make it. No. There's a simple prayer that a fellow who has been inspirational to me that uses back home in the program, and it's real simple. You know, it's just like he gets up in the morning, heads for the shower, and he says, God, if you're not there, I'm fucked. You know. And that's what it's been like to me, you know. I try, you know, it's like staying sober by just going to meetings is what my sponsor Joyce would say is like going into a chicken coop and becoming a chicken, you know. It just doesn't work. There's a whole lot more to the program than just going to meetings. And I've had to take that route. I skated my first 2.5 years on a 10-step program. I didn't want to have anything to do with the 6th and 7th. My character defects have character. And I could not let any of them go. And I have found out today that my worst one, my biggest one, is a bondage of self. And that's the only reason that I've been experiencing any anxiety. You know, it's been real hard to turn this over to my higher power, because my higher power, I don't think, is as funny as me. But then again, I know he has a sense of humor because he made us. My God. How am I doing, Louise? Oh, good. I've got it. No, I've got it today, and I had it yesterday, and if I do the same thing today that, yeah, tomorrow that I did today, I'll have it again tomorrow. I don't want to drink and drug today, and that's the biggest miracle in my life. That's the freedom that I've experienced. You know, the obsession being lifted, not wanting to use. And I really didn't think there was life after booze. And I have found out that there is. And Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me how to live that life because it is a learning process for me. I'm still learning, you know, and I'm getting honest, more honest, as I grow in this program. I really thought I was one of those who was emotionally incapable of being honest, and that was true for a long time. I had to work the how of the program backwards. I got willing and a little open, and I'm still working on the honesty. You know, that's coming in degrees. But it's wonderful to be alive, to be able to share, especially in this conference, coming, leaving the snow and coming to the rain. At least you don't have to shovel this. Detroit is not a place I'm proud to say I'm from, you know, because if you're wise, you carry a weapon there. And that's not how my higher power wants me to live. My higher power wants me to be joyous, happy, and free. And living in Detroit, that's difficult. There's a little wisdom to some fear. How many minutes I got here? A minute? My partner said she could tell me, she could get up here and tell my story in 10 minutes. So I asked her if she would. Please go. I can't do that. My God. I know that it's been about the most exciting trip I've ever been on, and I've tried everything out there. There's a lot of benefits to Alcoholics Anonymous for you new people. A lot of benefits. If there weren't, I wouldn't still be here. You know, I'm reaping rewards from sobriety. I wore tails for this occasion. I had another outfit on. Diane says, this one isn't serious enough. So for sure I had to wear this one because I got real serious about AA and I ended up getting drunk. Oh, that didn't work for me. You know, I'm real grateful for my sense of humor. It has pulled me through a lot of things. And I'm real grateful that I can laugh at myself today. And you. That's fun. That's more fun. Yeah, yeah. Some of us come in here and some of us are a little sicker than others. And I was one of those who was sicker than others. So I know, yes, the most knowledge I have today is I have a long way to go. And that's probably why I only got 10 minutes instead of being the main speaker. Wise woman. So, is it almost time? I'm dying for a cup of coffee. I have not quit drinking. I have just changed brands. I got up here and I have one in each hand, you know. So a whole lot of things haven't changed. I'm still addicted, you know, nicotine and caffeine. I'm sure if I moved out here, y'all would cure me of this. My God, your meetings. I went to a meeting in Santa Cruz. They wouldn't even let us use the John. I think they wanted that meeting to be, you know, eliminated out of the bank that it was in. Yeah, you know, stop. We can't use the John and no more coffee and can't go there no more. So I'm real glad to be here. I'm looking forward to the main speaker. I'm going to slip out and get another cup of coffee unless somebody wants to do that for me. Out of all you people. And black. Straight. Still straight. I still drink it straight. And I don't know. See, now I'm starting to relax and ready to tell you my story, and it's time to knock it off. This has been real thrilling. And the Adrillion is flowing. I love each and every one of you, especially the newcomer. Keep coming back. You know, you allow us to work our 12-step to the max, and that's what it's all about. It's a 12-step program, and I have to work them all. And that's not a big order. I want to share one thing. I heard Paul O. last Saturday. He's got a story in one of the editions of the Big Book, and he said that the exclamation on the part in the chapter 5 on what an order, I don't think I could go through with it, is what? Order? I can't go through with it. And that's how I read it when I first came in. So I have taken the suggestions that the program suggests, and it has worked for me. And I'm feeling pretty good, so I'll sit down now. Thank you.
Our main speaker today comes from the southern part of this state. And her home group is, well, I don't want to say anything to get in trouble, but that's how I sort of see it, is probably more responsible for this event here today than any other force that I know. Because as I have read the history of this conference, this Spring Fling was originated by Sacramento's primary purpose group.
Yay!
Oh, never mind that crap. Never mind that. And the primary purpose group, I believe, was a gracious attempt at trying to copy or be the Northern California clone of a group in Venice, California, called the Pacific. I don't even know if you'd call it a group or an outpatient clinic, you know. And I've had the very good fortune of watching this young lady grow in AA. I watched her grow another way last year, too, you know. And so let's give a good Sacramento welcome to Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sharon.
I got my roadmap Mary gave me. It's not notes. Well, it could be if you listen to my story. But we drove up here from Los Angeles. My baby, that's how he saw me grow last year, was I couldn't reach the podium. I had to stand sideways for a while. So my baby came, and another baby that I sponsored, Julie, and my babysitter, Robin, and we just hit five, and we didn't even look at a map. We just hit the road Friday afternoon, and God gave us a little weather. We played bumper cars with all those tumbleweeds, and We went to a Denny's to have a nice dinner, as nice as you can at Denny's, I guess. But the lights went out, but we were finished, so we had the exact change, and we left. But we've seen Button Willow or somewhere. I have no idea. Maybe it's on the map. I'll have to look. But we just kind of kept about a half hour ahead of the really bad stuff, I think. So, you know, we look at it as an adventure, and life to me is an adventure. It always was an adventure before, and it got very sad and very sorry and very sick and very lonely. And in sobriety, it's gotten very interesting, very full, always a new surprise around the corner, full of feeling, full of people, full of love. And I don't know any other way to live because I always wanted more, always. I always drank for more. I use drugs for more. I want more in life. I want more in sobriety. It's the way I'm made. And my first resentment growing up was when I realized I was living in Iowa. You know, I was fine until then. And I knew this wasn't it. And I knew that somewhere over there the grass was always greener, and I started that quest from an early, early age. And I had to come to AA to realize the reason the grass was greener was because the other guy was taking care of his lawn. I never figured that one out, ever. Figure that one out. Now, so in the meantime, my garden and my yard was full of weeds and bushes and thorns, and but I grew up in a normal family, and I'm the only alcoholic, and I don't know where that came from, other than it worked for me. And my sisters are successful, my brother's successful, my parents still live in the same house I grew up in, married 40-some years, I don't even keep track anymore, and they're all loving, good people, and I just had a different route to take. I always felt like the black sheep, and they abandoned me on the doorstep. And if I wouldn't look like everybody else, I'd still swear to it this day, but we all look alike to a certain extent. So that's a gift. I can at least know I'm probably from the same area, womb or whatever it's called. But I started to drink about 12, 13. I started to get drunk at 13 and 14. To fit in, of course. I was at a social situation on overnights, with a slumber party, whatever you call them, and they invited me because up until then I was still the good Catholic girl. And these girls were called the Savages. And I wanted so to be a part of the Savages. But I had promised my best friend, Beth, who wasn't invited because they knew they couldn't turn her, that I wouldn't drink and I wouldn't smoke cigarettes. But it was handed to me, and I took to it like a fish to water. And I learned how to drink, and I learned how to smoke that night. And I learned how to have a blackout. I don't know where I heard that, but I laid in the ditch. I was finding ditches already. I was laid in the ditch, and I listened to them around me talking about how funny I was and how great it was that I was becoming a part of them. And I thought, you know, I thought my life would change right at that moment. It did to an extent. I got a rotten attitude, is what happened. But I thought I would grow the boobs like the rest of them. I thought, you know, I would have the fuzz around the class ring, you know, whatever, the mohair that they used to put around the class rings. All of it. I thought that, you know, this was it and it was going to change my life. But none of that stuff happened. What happened was I found something magic in the alcohol, because it filled the holes inside of me that I always had. I always had holes inside of me. It made me funny. It made me fit in. I had a big capacity. I was driving in blackouts before I had a license. I would drive you home. I would keep the party going. I was friends with all the guys in the neighborhood, and I would watch where they hide their booze, and then I'd go back, and then I would steal their booze, and then we'd invite them to our party. And I always kept the party going, you know. And then once I was 16 and 17 and 18, 16 and 17 in high school, I stayed out a lot. And I would get up on a Sunday morning with a hangover, going out to my mother's car, pulling the weeds and wiping the mud off it, not knowing how I had gotten home, where I had been. and going off to church, you know. And that remorse and that guilt and the feeling like I was just a nothing was inside of me. But boy, Saturday night about 11 o'clock, you couldn't have told me that. You know, I'm dancing with the best looking guy at the dance. He smells like English leather. We're in the back seat of his car working on a six pack of beer. You know, life was in session. It was terrific. I felt more whole and at peace when I was drinking than I did at any other time in my life. When I found drugs, I smoked grass. I started to take uppers, diet pills. I loved Prelude and Entrance. I had a doctor that would send them to me no matter where I was living in the country. I'd just call him up, and he'd send a prescription to a drugstore for me. And I used to strip them away and take the little black thing in the middle because you could go a lot longer, you know? That's what Kathy said, you could go all night. And it worked for me for a long time, and then it used to put me to sleep. I'd take six black mollies, and I'd just be zonked at the bar sleeping because it had some sort of reverse effect on me. But my drug of choice was always alcohol, too, because if I couldn't control it, it controlled me. I would take 6, 8, 10 hits of acid in one night, and I could control it. I like to walk into a restaurant and sit down and order. Not that I'm going to eat the food because it's swimming around the plate anyway, you know. But I like to see if I could control it, you know. I like to walk into a place and buy a pair of shoes when I was going like that. I used to like to go home to my parents when I was in college, and my eyes would be like saucers, and I'd tell them we're going to have this new relationship, I've been through an electrical storm to get here, and this was intense. I woke them up one night to do this, and my father took me out and showed me the moon and the stars, and I told them, call me Mama Cher, call me Cher, that's my new name, and you're going to be Marge, and you're going to be Frank, and we're going to have this intense relationship. And they just... My father said, I'm paying for this college education. I had a lot of fun in college. I started off with the Bobby Brooks matching sweaters and skirts. I went to the Democratic Convention in 1968 to campaign for McCarthy. I ended up following Dick Gregory to Mayor Daley's house. In a march, I got tear gas. I lost my shoe. I was in that park where all the police were coming down. I didn't know what was happening, but what happened when I left Chicago was I was in blue jeans and bell bottoms, rings around my ankles. And, this in one hand and this in the other hand, you know. Two-finger salute and a one-finger salute. And there was always alcohol and always drugs around that scene, and I fell right into it. I loved it. I went to a lot of rallies. I would hitchhike to Washington, D.C. to get my moratorium button. Only reason I would go, you know, from wherever I was living at the time. And I was into all of that. I had a big mouth, and I was getting a little bit angry at this point in my life. I was mad at my father. I was mad at the world. I was mad at the war. I was mad at the church. I was mad at God. You know, you just put me in front with a banner and tell me what to say, and you got it. You know? And that's what happened. And my father came down after I had a suicide attempt. I think it was more for attention because it hurt. You know, once it hurt, I quit. But... I wasn't real sincere. But he came down to talk to me, and he brought the family priest, and we got drunk. Me and this priest got so drunk. My father sent me to a psychiatrist. I sat there like this. I went to a lot of psychiatrists people sent me to. I sat there with my arms folded, tapping my foot, a sneer on my face, and thought, if somebody's paying for this, buddy, you can figure it out. I'm not talking, you know? And that was my attitude. That was my attitude. So life kind of, it got a little bit lonely and a little bit busy, and I had to start moving a lot. I went to New York City because my dad quit paying for my college education, and New York City was fun for a while. I played the little girl from Iowa role. I could still do that. I could still dress up and go off. And I got a nice advertising job in the Pan Am building. And they liked me, and they took two-hour drinking lunches. And if you were late in the morning, you could close your door and sleep it off. And they liked me, and they were good to me. But at night, I would go home and put on my black top hat, my long black coat, and I would walk the West Side. And I went to the West End Bar and the Golden Rail up there near Columbia University, and I had my head read every Friday afternoon by a phrenologist because the bumps would change periodically, and they would tell me about where my life was going by reading the bumps on my head. And I was into the I Ching and tarot, and I had made friends with a lot of the Scientologists were around then, a lot of the Krishnas. But if they ever tried to follow me home or found out where I lived or made me sign here or do any of that stuff, I was gone. I'm a non-committal person, thank you. Most of my life before I got here, if I couldn't carry it, I didn't want to own it. And that's the way it was. And otherwise, I probably also would have been married 4 or 5 times, but it was just, it was too much forever for me. And I always had that fear of ending up in Iowa on a pig farm. You know? They look like somebody, but they're going to take me to Iowa, and we're going to have a pig farm and 6 kids. I know it. So I just kind of stayed one step ahead, all that stuff. But New York, I got very strange. I started getting very, very paranoid. I had a free ticket to Woodstock and a ride, and I couldn't get off my windowsill. I was on my windowsill on a cockroach killing spree that weekend. I had ran out of cockroach killing spray, and I was like, I don't know, I was very, I had my bottle, and I was very loaded on acid. I don't know how much. That's when Orange Sunshine was around, which was really the pure stuff. You could lick your fingers and stick it into a bag and lick your fingers all day long. It's just always going in your pores. So, I'm killing these cockroaches. I'm on my windowsill. I'm out of the spray can. I'm 6 floors down to the street. And they come to get me to go to Woodstock. And between me and them was the world. I mean, the cockroaches, and they was just like, go have a good time, And I missed it, I missed it. But who knows? Maybe I would have been one of those that was run over or something. Because, I mean, God is good to us that we have survived long enough to end up here. That we have survived all the crap we survived, whether it's in your closet, in your bedroom, out in the street, to get here. And that's a gift. That's a gift. So in New York, I couldn't ride subways anymore, so I spent all my money on cabs. I got very, very paranoid, and I just said, this isn't it. Please, Daddy, one more semester. And Daddy put me back into school one more time. And that was certainly short-lived because he came to see me, and I was cleaning a pound of grass on the table one day. And he said, okay. And he put my bags on the doorstep, literally. And I went to Colorado. I don't know why. I guess I always wanted to be a cowgirl. I was a Hopalong Cassidy fan, as a kid or something. And I had a Davy Crockett hat, So somewhere in there, it made good sense at the time. Let's go off and become a cowgirl. So I ended up in Colorado, and it was near Aspen, and it was gorgeous. And I got a nice job in this restaurant where they were, equestrian people, a cut above, right? And they accepted me, and they liked me, and I was doing all right and not causing too much trouble in the Mountain Man Bar, which was the local bar. I'd occasionally pass out on the shuffleboard as I was pushing the shuffle. I would just kind of lay my arm out and pass out there. But, sawdust will clean off you easy, but I met this guy, walked into the restaurant one morning. He ordered a milkshake to go. I made 2 to go and left with him because he looked like Bob Dylan. We ended up somewhere in Utah. I found out he wasn't Bob Dylan. But we were on our way to California for the first time, and that's how I got here for the first time. And he went his way, and I went mine, and I ended up on Huntington Beach at a commune. And I turned 21 out in by UCLA. Panhandled. I was still in a panhandling. I panhandled for my 2 bottles of wine on my 21st birthday. I broke into the botanical gardens and swept it off. I went to Seal Beach, smoked angel dust under a blanket, and I thought, what a birthday. What a birthday. And I watched my tracks in the sand as I got higher and higher and watched how the patterns went. And then I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach. And he went his way and I went mine. I ended up there and he went somewhere and I never saw him again. But maybe he was Bob Dylan. I don't know. I listen to the songs sometimes and think, we were there. But fantasies are always fun. But so this commune, they cooked with grass. They made their teas with grass. Everything was dope. They drank a lot of wine and I was at home. And they liked me. And I stayed for, 4 months. I came with $2, I left with $5 and a dog. And ended up back in Colorado for a couple of months, driving around these mountain, these icy mountain roads with bald tires and this old black Plymouth with Stop War painted on the trunk. It was from the Berkeley riots. I was so proud of this car. Somebody willed to me. Just sick and crazy and just drunk all the time. I ended up back home in Iowa that winter, and that was one place I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be back home where my father and I couldn't even look each other in the eye. We would meet in the hallway and just kind of go our own way, because if we started, that was it. My mother was always between us, and I could stay in that house as long as I didn't take drugs. It was okay to drink, and I was just like the thing that lived upstairs that winter. And of course, I smoked grass because that wasn't drugs. But I was in the taverns in this small town of 3,500 people every night that winter. And there were four taverns at the one red light in town. And I would rotate so people wouldn't know I was drinking every night. And I would think I was on the same rotation schedule as Billy Lang, because I remember being half drunk a couple of times and looking at the Billy Lang down at the end of the bar. And I thought, God, I knew he was going to be a loser, you know. Sitting in here every night getting sloshed, you know. I'm in there every night looking at Billy Lang getting sloshed every night. Couldn't figure that one out. I was miserable. I went to church a couple weekends in a row. I read books like I'm Okay, You're Okay, until I get mad and try to break the wall with them. I tried to get some sort of help. I would wake up at 4 in the morning with leg cramps and sick and my stomach cramping, and I would go down at the foot of my mother and just lay there, and she would just say, go back to bed before you wake your father. They didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know what to do with me. I was an alcoholic and a sick woman at 21, and nobody knew it. You know, I didn't know it, they didn't know it. That spring I met him, and I had already had my heart broken once when I was 18, and I thought, never again. But let's just say I was teachable about this time. I don't want to live at home anymore. And he was 6'8", so our eyes met, of course, you know. I always thought I was taller anyway. So I have a lot of out-of-body floating experiences. But he kind of walked across the room at me, and he had the Indian gauze clothing on, that cotton stuff that kind of floats in the wind, you know. And I just thought it was my angel Gabriel. You know, he had these long, curly black locks and John Lennon glasses, and he was here to save me. And he was into organic living. So Phil and I set off to Wisconsin to buy an organic farm and live on an organic farm, and he was going to fix me. And they found out I had a non-functioning, non-fixable gallbladder that they had to take out surgically, that a girl my age didn't have, and what do I drink and what do I use? Well, not anymore. And the next guy, a couple of weeks, doctor, you know, I don't have any self-honesty going. Drugs? No, I don't. Buffalo grass, they go to speed, nothing, you know. But they took this out, and Phil went to work, and I ended up taking care of the sheep all day long, and he took my cigarettes away and rolled me packs of joints, is what he did. And he said, you can smoke these. So I was stoned all the time. And he had a lot of organic wine sitting around for me to drink. And that's what we were into. We bought a wood stove and a wood heater, and we ground our own wheat. We made our own bread. You know, we were into it. And we chopped our wood, we buzzsaw. We were so loaded with these big buzzsawing wood, and then you had to chop it, and then you had to split it. And the morning you wake up in northern Wisconsin with just icicles everywhere, and you'd have to go down in the basement and split this wood, get the furnace going, get everything going, you know. And I don't get out of bed without a joint. I mean, I don't. And I would, like, just one-eyed chop all this wood up all the time. And I missed my toe this morning, you know. I remember thinking that one day when I came very close to chopping my toe off. You know, I was like, great, I missed my toe. And it was a lot of work. I never really realized how much work it was until about 6 years of sobriety, and one day it just hit me. Oh, my God. You know, I thought that's what I wanted. It was a lot of work. We had the sheep, and we had to take care of the sheep and this horse, and I would wait for Mother Earth News to come. That was the big deal. It would come in the mail, and we read Gil Gibbons, and, you know, we went to Minneapolis to the co-op to buy, and you know, I don't use a sewing machine. I stitch by hand, so I would do all this hand stitching of clothing, and Jesus Christ, it was just, you know. You know, it's like I'm doing penance for something. I don't know what it is. I'll be good was I. What was I in my other life? I'm sorry, you know. But I remember one winter storm, and we had had one already, and this was the second big one coming. When they came up there, they came for days. And I got in that car, and I went into Connersville, which is just a general store, and I got me 2 gallons of the cheapest wine I could find. And I came home, and I drank them. And Phil stood there, all 6'8" of him, with his arms folded, going, "You have to get so disgustingly drunk." And I thought, you know what happened? Click. A little notch just clicked in my head, and I thought, come spring, I'm not going to need him anymore. You know? Of course, come spring, right? It's a lot to wrap around you. But anyway, I thought, no, alcohol was more important than him, this lifestyle, this houseload of antique furniture his mother had given us, all of that crap, all the maple syrup we had made and labeled. We used to go out and tap these maple trees, and you'd be stoned, and you'd go out there on the crust of the snow, and you'd come back with these huge buckets, and you'd sink to your thighs, and it was an all-day event, you know? And he had longer legs than me, and he'd be way up there somewhere, and I'm, like, coming from behind, you know? I'm so glad I didn't fall into a cult, because I would have been such a good follower, just keeping me loaded, you know, just keeping me loaded. I'm grateful, because when I got here, I was teachable for anything. So come spring, Phil kind of went his way, and I went mine after we planted our garden, which was organic, and we were going to sell the vegetables. But that half a mile back in the woods, we planted a half acre of marijuana. And that was my baby. That was mine. And it grew 12 feet tall. The other garden went to weeds. I didn't care. Yeah. And I used to go out there, me and Poncho the horse would spend days out there. Days out there. I would get hungry, I'd eat it, you know? Saw a lot of bears and owls out there. But life was simple now because I could drink like I wanted. Everybody was gone. All my organic friends were into primal therapy, and that was fine. But I wasn't going to pay $2,500 to go scream at somebody. I'd do it to the sheep, you know? I'd do a lot more drinking on $2,500, and I wanted to be alone anyway. My only friend was Clarence the farmer, and he'd come and bring the booze every night. And he had his license taken away for being drunk. So he would drive his tractor, and he and his tractor would bring the booze. And Clarence sometimes would put in his teeth, and other nights he wouldn't put in his teeth. But it didn't matter because he brought the booze. Me and this toothless wonder would sing Indian love songs on my pink piano and listen to my album Blue by Joni Mitchell over and over again. And that was my life, and I was perfectly content because I could drink like I wanted, I could smoke dope like I wanted, and I didn't have any responsibilities. That was my life. And I went to do my first big dope deal, and I forgot the dope. And that's how I was going to leave Wisconsin, you see, was by selling it all, because it was cold. No more winters up here. So what happened that evening was me and my dog were embarrassed, so we just kind of, we turned around, and about 2 blocks away I saw a merry-go-round and a Ferris wheel and lights and a lot happening over there. And I thought, that's good, I've never been a gypsy, and I've always wanted to be a gypsy. So that night, me and my dog got a job, and we packed up our trunk, and we packed up all our marijuana, and in this big car with the sun painted on the hood, and we joined the carnival, and we left the house full of furniture. We didn't care. And for the next 4 or 5 months, we joined this carnival. And I was a shooting gallery girl. And my dog was always by me. And if you got too close to me, my dog would bite your ankles. And I could drink like I wanted. And they had the speed, and I had the dope. And it was a nice trade-off. And they got into town and partied hard, and they left town and partied hard. And I liked that. I liked that. I didn't care anymore. About this time is when I stopped calling my mom, because I would be calling my mom from Arkansas, Missouri. You know, she just didn't want to hear it anymore. It was too painful. I could hear it in her voice. So I met this guy. His name was Kirby, and he and I fell into love for about 2 weeks. and into a very violent, sick relationship for about 2 years after that. It took that long for God to remove it from me, I guess. But we got busted for drugs in Bogalusa, Louisiana, me and Kirby. And the carnival left town. Bye. See you later. No magazines, no cigarettes, you know. I just kind of left town and left us in this jail in Bogalusa, Louisiana. And they knew where to find my stuff. They knew where to find it hidden in the dog food. They knew where to find everything. And I don't know, I felt set up. Could have been. Maybe we're paranoid, as somebody said, but I felt set up. And I was in jail for 30 days, and I made friends with the right people, and I drank that home brew. I didn't care. You hold your nose and drink it, you get high, you know. I got feed when I was in jail. I did what I had to do to get high. And then they let me out, and they said that I was going to have to pay this big fine, or maybe I was going to have to do time. They didn't know, but I better go find some place to make some money and don't leave the state. So I went across Lake Pontchartrain, and I found New Orleans. And I fell in love with the French Quarter. And I did not leave there except for periodically for 4 years. It's like 12 blocks by about 8 block area that after you get to know people, you can feel your way home, you know, along the walls. And I lived, Kirby and I lived with, first of all, we lived with an ex-Marine and a retired drag queen. And they set us up and they let us live there. And I used to go to work dancing on Bourbon Street. And Kenny used to like to make me up with his platinum wigs and this hearts painted on my cheek and all this makeup and platform shoes and fishnet stockings and short skirts. And we had a pet skunk and a pet snake and my dog and the skunk Crank. He would sometimes walk with me on his little leash down Bourbon Street to work, for I was a dancer. And nobody knew what I was. And I loved it. I loved it because I'm into costumes now. Now, I'm one of those alcoholics. When I drink, I don't get thin, even though I don't eat. I bloat. So after a while, I was known as Mama Cher. And I fell off the stage more than on. And I asked for a raise after one Mardi Gras. And they said, you got to be kidding. And I became a bartender in defiance. Because that's what I did well, you know. I drank well. And I drank at places where they like you to drink with the people. And then I got nicer jobs. And then I got fired from those nicer hotel jobs for being drunk on the job, you know. And I had to sign those little waivers that put you in the computer, and you can never get a job at the nice hotels anymore. So who cares anyway? I get in with more of the local crowd, and you got to, you know, you got a tab at my bar. I got one at yours. You know, you take care of me when I pass out at your bar. I'll take care of you when you pass out at my bar. And I like to drink in the places like the Bastille and Funky Butts anyway, in places like that, because you never knew if it was day or night. So somebody cracked that door, and then it was like all the vampires in the world just You know, it's unbelievable. I loved that town. Every other place was a bar in the quarter. And I was not a pretty drunk now. I was a violent drunk now. I was a very sick, paranoid drunk. I used to like to start fights with my mace and back off. I would start fights with bikers and then back off and watch them kill each other, you know. Kirby and I lived above a biker bar called the Mousetrap, and they called the police more on us than they did on the people in their own bar, because we would have knife fights, and we would beat each other up, and we lived next to an S&M hooker, and it was just insane. It was a nut. About this time, my parents came to visit me. My mother cried into a baked potato. My father shook his head and couldn't even look me in the eye. And that was the last I saw them for a long time. But they didn't know what to do. They didn't know I was an alcoholic. I'm so glad they know it now, because maybe they can help somebody else, you know. But I had a ways to go yet. I was still defiant. I was still angry. And Kirby's parole got pulled to St. Louis, and I followed him because no one's leaving me. Should have been glad. I ended up in St. Louis when I found him, and he crashed his motorcycle helmet through the window, pulled my head through, spit in my face, said if he ever saw me again, he'd kill me. And the only reason he didn't that night was because there was a police car behind us. And I believed him, and I came back to New Orleans. And I remember coming back. I couldn't get a lot of nice jobs back. I moved my way down to Decatur Street, which isn't the nicer part of the quarter, but I fit in just fine. And I had my Jose Cuervo on the back bar just like I always did, because nobody ever... If I was a bartender working your shift, I made sure I had Jose Cuervo gold, and I always had 2 bottles for my shift. I remember one Mardi Gras working, I'd gone through a quart and a half, and my shift's not even half over yet, And I remember thinking, the thoughts that creep in somewhere along the line, isn't that a lot? Isn't that a lot of booze? I don't know where that came from, you know? Things were happening, like I just said, in my favorite bar, my favorite bar stood, my favorite three songs going, my favorite bartender on, I got 2 days off to do whatever I want, and it's not happening. I'm on my 14th tequila, and there's no click. The head doesn't shut off. The emotions don't shut off. There's no click. And that scared me. You know, things like I couldn't speak unless I had a couple of shots. You know, things like that were happening. I had red splotches always under my cheeks. I never knew where they came from, and makeup never covered up. I didn't know. I couldn't even part my hair anymore because my hand would shake until I would get some booze down me in the morning. I learned to do that. I learned to drink in the morning. You know, I had a good alcoholic teach me how to do that. I went to Florida for a while. I almost killed a lot of people in a car. I came back to New Orleans. I worked that Mardi Gras of 75. I don't really remember too much of that, those whole 10 days. But I remember the last day my friend Michael came to get me, and I don't know, he snorted something. I don't know what it was. I was always on amyl nitrate anyway. It was always in my pocket. I had my bottle of Jose Cuervo in one hand. And we bought some booze, and we're walking home to my apartment on Mardi Gras Day, and he has this gun. And he pulls this gun out, and he starts to threaten people on the street. And I said, oh, Michael, it's Mardi Gras Day. Put away your gun. You know? It's not like, oh, my God, what is going on here? Let's go party. You know? So we went back to my place, and I went out to get some more booze. I don't remember. I'm in one of those brownout states, kind of here, kind of there. And I guess what happened was he went in my balcony and started shooting at people on the street, and somebody called the police, and I guess I was the last one to talk to him alive. I don't remember, but I guess I asked him to leave and shut the door. I'm standing by my bathroom, which is about 6 feet away from this door, and we hear these shots, and I know something happened to Michael outside that door, but I look at everybody hit the deck, and I said, I'm taking a bath. And that was my reality. I'm taking a bath. I closed that door. I ran the water. I took any drugs that were in the bathroom because I knew the police were on their way. And I made them break down the door and take me that day. And they took me to homicide, and they came in and they talked to me about what kind of a woman I was, because I couldn't say a thing. There was nothing coming out of my mouth. And they told me how disgusting I was and what kind of woman thing I had become, and they were right. And I didn't know what to do with that, but hang on to reality, because if I let go of that reality, I went to the places where the nuns never let you out. I knew that. That's why I never checked into hospitals. I knew they wouldn't let me out. So I hung on to that thread that day, and I went to New York to recuperate to my sisters. And I hid out for a month, and that's what I did. You know, I drank Jack Daniel's, smoked hash, read books, and ate bagels for a month. Because that was a traumatic thing that had happened to me. I had to identify Michael's body. I didn't know what happened. How did these things happen? They always happen to somebody else. Always do. And I got saved one more time by some guys that were writing a book, and I was an artist in a bar. As long as you could be what you wanted to be, let me be what I want to be in a bar. I'll just draw those pictures on those cocktail napkins and sign my name, you know. And you can be the brain surgeon with the shaking hands who's got surgery tomorrow. I don't care. Just let me be who I want to be, you know. You sit there and spin those dreams together in a bar. That's why I loved it. I could be anything I wanted to be when it was working. And when it wasn't working, it was terrifying. But we went off and we set off across country to write this book on American Indian arts and crafts. And I was going to draw these baskets and Indians. And we had the photographer and we had the writer. And we had $6,000, you know. We saw more bars than Indians. They left me on the road somewhere and came back and got me because they felt sorry for me. They tried to teach me to drink. Because I was going too fast. I'd take two or three drinks and be gone. It was the altitude. Up and down. We were going up and down. It was Thrifty's. The Winner's Cup vodka you bought, for God's sake. You know, let's buy something good, like Jose Cuervo Gold, you know? It was that stuff. I kept a journal because my sister, for some reason, said keep a journal. And I found it when I was about 4 years sober, and it said things like, I didn't get drunk today. You know, and that's not a lot to shoot for when you're 25 years old. And you had a lot of potential at one time in your life and a lot of dreams that now were just so far gone I couldn't even remember them. I didn't start to remember my dreams and what I wanted to be in sobriety until I was about 8 years sober, you know. So I ended up in California again. They went their way, I went mine. It was another sick relationship. I ended up at Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood. Well, they closed at 2 a.m. And I did not understand. I was a mad woman. They were dragging out of the bar because they were closed. and I have to go back to the Tropicana and wait for the bars to open in the morning. And then I got smart, and I started to buy a bottle, of, you know, a gallon of wine to have back at the room. And then the money ran out, and then I stayed here, and I stayed there. And about this time, I remember being in Barney's one time, and two girls called their AA meeting. They called a cab and had big books under their arms and drunk. They got drunk and laughing and having a great time going to an AA meeting. I had no idea what it was all about. I had no idea at all. And that was a seed that was planted because one of those girls was a girl named Chris. But I tried to kill myself in her apartment. I took all the pills in the medicine chest, and they poured black coffee down and found me and walked me around and put me on a plane back to New Orleans. Bye-bye. I ended up back in New Orleans. I couldn't get my job back in Decatur Street. I met a guy going to Hawaii. He had rolls of money and buying an Agnes of champagne, and I said, sure, let's go. Because I could not stay in one spot because everything would catch up to me. I had to stay one step ahead of me all the time. I couldn't look myself in the mirror at all. And I would catch a glimpse of myself maybe in a shop window, and it would just repulse me. I had to keep moving, you know. And I couldn't kill myself, so now I've got that death wish, wishing somebody to do it for me. I ended up in Barney's Beanery again, West Hollywood. He went his way, I went mine. I never got to Hawaii. Who knows? Maybe I would have died there, too. But I met two guys going to Palm Springs on motorcycles that night, and boy, I was ready, you know. Let's go. We drove into Palm Springs on a Sunday morning with my... I'd forgotten the two-handed wave. We're a one-handed wave now. All the Cadillacs and all the Jaguars. Hi! I'm here. Defiant, angry, fat, ugly, disgusting thing that couldn't even get drunk anymore. They left me in the nightclub because I was too disgusting for them. And I guess I made some new friends that night because the next thing I remember was getting my face kicked in. And they, these guys that I had ended up with that night broke my jaw in three places, broke my nose, raped me and drugged me around on the cement for a while. Then they have a cliff about 6 in the morning and left me there to bleed to death. And that was July 27th, 75. Now, what happened that morning was, I didn't really think of anything but, when I heard the car door slam, I remember coming to, and I remember thinking, I've got to get out of here because they're coming back. And I want to live. And that got me up the side of that cliff, and that got me down about a half a mile down a road to somebody's condominium where I guess I couldn't wake them up. And I passed out in a lawn chair about a foot from the pool, and the gardener found me. Now, the police came. The ambulance came. I'm in a situation where I'm finally a legitimate victim. I have been wearing black forever waiting for the script, right? I am a legitimate victim. It's not going to happen in their town. And a funny thing happened to me, wheeling me into surgery that morning. I knew I did that to me. I knew it wasn't the Catholic Church. It wasn't my father. It wasn't George who broke my heart at 18. It wasn't any of that stuff. I knew I did it to me. Now, I didn't know what to do with that, you know. I laid in intensive care for a couple of weeks. I got a lot of get-well cards and no money. And my mother heard something had happened to me, and they didn't know for 2 days if I was alive or dead because they got a panic call from somebody who hung up before they knew where I was. But for 2 days, my mother didn't know where I was or what was happening to me. She didn't contact me. My sister contacted me to find out what was going on. And this guy felt sorry for me that I had met in the bar in Barney's, and he said I could come stay with him when I got out. And he lived above a liquor store in West L.A., so I went to live with this guy above a liquor store in West L.A., and that was fine because I'm on a liquid diet anyway. I got these wires all over my face, and I'd stick a straw where the tooth was, you know. I could suck on this red wine he was buying me. And I was a broken woman, a broken spirit, you know. I knew I had to go back to court. They caught these guys. I knew that I had to stay around for these doctors because I didn't know how I was going to end up, you know. I was tired. There was no way I was going to go stick my thumb out on that road anymore. And August 20th, the guy said I had to leave. His girlfriend wanted to move in. So I did the only thing that I knew to do, which was call my mom. Collect, of course. And my mother said to me that she could not help me anymore and I should go to the Salvation Army. And Mom always sent me $20, at least, you know. But if Mom would have sent me $20, you'd have a different speaker today because I would have waited for that $20 two or three days. I would have waited, and I would have gotten drunk. And next time I probably would have died. But my mother, without knowing it, started the wheels in motion for me, because the next girl I called was this girl, Chris, who had been to an AA meeting. Now, the only reason I called her next was because her number was there in front of me. You know, my God was good to me. He set in wheels in motion in my life that I had no idea what was happening. You know, it was like a domino effect. It's fortuitous events. I don't know how to explain it. I called Chris. Chris recognized my problem. She said, I can't help you anymore, but this woman will. Chris also knew me. She said, I'm not going to give you the number unless you call. So she kind of goaded me, because I was always a good one for that. You know, don't threaten me. I'll do it. So I called. I said, I'll call. So I called this woman named Suzanne, who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that. I didn't know I was going to end up in an AA meeting that night. I had no idea what I was doing. I was just calling. I had to go somewhere, you know. And Suzanne told me, she started to read my mail over the phone. Isn't that funny how we do that? She said, don't drink anything today and don't smoke anything either, you know. And I put my joint down because I knew that's what she meant. And she said, just wait, and these two girls will come get you at 7 o'clock. And they did. And they had bright smiles and blonde hair, and they were California all over. Boy, just like I always thought when I was a kid reading Teen Magazine. I want to look like that, and I want to be out there, you know? And they were an example to me. They put me in the back of a red Volkswagen, and it was hot. And they would turn around every red light and share with me. And I couldn't get the windows down. I couldn't go anywhere. And they took me all the way to Echo Park to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, where the Pacific Group was meeting that Wednesday night. Now, they shuffled me in the door. The man had a tie on. He was kind to me. He said hello. I mean, he looked like a successful man that said, welcome. He didn't go, I won't give you 5 cents for that thing, honey, you know, because I was still asking, you know. But he was nice to me, and he was kind to me. And they came in, and they sat me down in front, and some man that looked like my grandfather came up to me and gave me the 20 questions. And he said, here, take this. So I didn't know. Checking away, I had 17. He was so excited. He was so excited. I passed. I thought, oh, good, I made somebody that looked like my grandfather happy. That's about all I remember about the meeting. They raised my hand for me. I don't remember anything about the meeting other than at the end of it, they had this big blue book, and they held this blue book up, and I swore I heard him pound on it, you know, and I thought, oh, God, where's the holy water? Here we go. You know, where do I sign? Who wants my worldly possessions? Where do I fill out the application with what my potential was, my IQ, how much money my father made, all of that stuff Nancy talked about? They didn't ask. They didn't care. They didn't say, oh, my God, you've got a T-shirt with bleach stains on. Broken Huarache shoes. Your blue jeans don't fit. You're coming out of them. You know, I hadn't combed this long, scraggly hair. I had these wires on my mouth. I had raccoon eyes for about 3 months. And I was just a mess. And they didn't say, you can't come in here. Or they didn't say, go sit back there in the corner. They said, come up here and sit. Welcome. We need you. Keep coming back. All that stuff that made no sense, but somewhere inside it started the fire of hope. Somewhere inside it started that fire that I didn't even know was happening, because I didn't even, for 2 weeks, I didn't know I was coming to AA. They just picked me up and dropped me off, and picked me up and dropped me off. And that's it. You know, that's my group. That's the group I'm still with today. They loved me until I knew where I even was, you know. They gave me a sleeping bag and moved me out of that liquor store, and I slept on this girl's floor for a week, on that girl's floor for a week. People started giving me clothes. After a while, I would kind of slide up to somebody who looked like he'd have a little money, and in my wisdom way, with my wires on my mouth. For 3 months, I had wires on my mouth so that the mouth closed and the ears opened, right? You know? I had to learn to listen, and I had to shut my mouth, and thank God I did that, because I was teachable. I was beaten teachable. I was teachable. The timing, I was ripe. And if you're new and you're here and you hurt, good. I'm glad, because there's nowhere to go but up. Nowhere to go but up. So me and my Vons paper bags moved around for a while. And life got very interesting. Like I said, I would try to see if I could get some money out of somebody, because I have to go back to New Orleans to get my clothes. You know, it was real important, right? All these drag queen clothes that I should go back and get, right? See how my skunk's doing, my turtles, you know. They would just look at me, give me change, and say, call your sponsor, kid. And the only reason I got a sponsor is because a guy with a Texas accent one night stuck his finger on me, touched me, and said, you better get a sponsor or you're going to get drunk. And I thought, I don't like this man. So I'm going to get a sponsor so he won't touch me anymore. Motives don't count. Thank God. I sat on a lot of bar stools with wonderful motives. I never did anything. I thought I had all the answers to things. I never asked questions. I came in here, I started to ask questions. I started to take the actions in a positive direction instead of sitting around waiting to be pure of heart. We'd still be waiting to be pure of heart, you know? Once in a while now, I have a good motive and a good feeling about doing something, and then I wonder where that came from. I have to judge that, of course. But I got a sponsor, and she moved me up to her couch. Boy, you know, that was a plus for sponsorship. She made me read 3 pages of that book a night. It was all I could handle, really, just to read the black words. She made me get on my knees at the edge of that sleeping bag at night. I'd make sure she'd go to bed, and I'd make sure she was asleep before I did that. You know, and tell God thank you for keeping me safe, sane, and sober today. I couldn't work for a while because of my physical condition, so she would make me walk to the library and go through the index cards. It was a 2-block walk, and it seemed like 2 years. She would say, go smell some flowers today and tell me what color they are tonight. She gave me simple directions like that. I went to 2 meetings a day for a long time. Then they took the wires off. Then I had to go back to work. And I wanted to be a bartender again. And she said, no, I don't think so. I think let's just start as a waitress. And I gritted my teeth. But I did it. And I worked funny shifts. And I got a better job as a waitress. And I learned how to fake it till you feel it. I learned how to show up for work because I'd call her at 6 in the morning. And she'd be pissed because I'd wake her up. I didn't realize that. And I'd tell her that I don't feel well today. And maybe I should go back to bed and call in. And she'd say, you go to work. I don't care how you feel. If you want to die, we'll give you an AA funeral, but you go to work. Quick. She'd hang up on me. And I would have tear-stained little white waitress shoes as I would go to work with a long face, rotten attitude. You don't make any money that way if you have your waitress. I started to figure that out. They said, come on, Sharon. I said, but that's being a phony. I was so into what's real and what's phony. What's faking it till you feel it, you know? It's like, shut up, kid, and just go and smile. Just go and do it. So I would give them one of those nice Teepee Alamon smiles, you know? And I'd have a few cups of coffee myself, and somebody'd be nice to me, and then we'd start our day. And I found out you could start your day over at 2 in the afternoon. You could go start your day over. What a gift! I thought if you woke up and it was screwed for a week, you know? I found out little simple tools how to live. I had no idea how to live. I was missing the day in school I gave out those rules. I was gone, missing. And I never asked any questions because I have too much pride. That's my number one defect, you know? I have too much pride to ask any questions. I'll figure it out on my own. Still today, I'm a lot that way. I have to go through a lot of the pain. You can tell me, this road's tough, this road's smooth. And I'll say, yeah, okay, it looks nice down there, but this one's more interesting, you know? But being a sponsor, I try to do that for people, too, just at least point it out. But most of the time, we're so stubborn, we got to go the rough one a while before we lose sight of who's at the other end and go, help, and run back. Okay, let's walk the smooth road now. But doesn't matter what you do in your sobriety, you know. It doesn't matter what you do. If you don't drink and you don't use, it's going to get better. You know, you got to practice these principles in all your affairs, though. I do. You know, that's my opinion. Because at night when I go to bed and I say thank you, and I go over my day, maybe I screwed up here, maybe I screwed up there. But I can forgive myself because I tried, and I stayed sober, and tomorrow morning's a new day. I was taught how to live in the now. I didn't know what one day at a time meant, and this old-timer overheard me saying to a friend, but I can't. I can't make plans for tomorrow night's meeting. It's one day at a time. I'll just... And he very, very kindly took me aside and said, Sharon, you can make plans. It's all right to fill up your calendar. Emotionally, all we have to handle is today. Oh, okay. I was very, very teachable, and I had a lot of teachers around me. And things like that had to be explained to me. So these silly, simple logos, you know, they had to be explained to me. I got a better job as a travel agent. I found out I hated to fly sober. So I had to take these tours down to Mexico of these travel agents and sell our property. And they're all drinking, having a wonderful time, and I'm hanging onto the seat with both hands, knuckling it, going, okay, let's see, now how's it go? I got to have faith, not fear. Faith, not fear. There's only room in my heart for one. Faith, not fear. Faith, not fear. All the way down, you know? Dipping that seat. You know, and you get these Aeromexico pilots that love to just give you a good ride, you know? I remember once I asked Clancy something about fear of flying. He said, just don't watch the wings. That's all I could do. Classical music on the air, watch the wings in the storm, you know? And what I had to do was realize God either is or he isn't. And if he isn't, we're all dead anyway. So I had to put God in the plane because there's always a seat in first class. You know, there's always a seat there for him. And God came with me. God started to come with me in the car. God started to come with me on interviews. God started to come with me in my home. God started to come with me. God started to become an integral part of me because of fear, you know. So you just do what you got to do. Because my first guide when I was sober was Beacons. Beacons Moving Van. They said pick anything. So I saw a Beacons Moving Van, and in my little mind, it made sense because I had been here and I had been there. And I thought, okay, I'm like an old bureau. There's a chip here and a scratch there. But, you know, God always wrapped me tight and got me to my destination. Beacons, okay. Made sense. So today when I see a beacon, it's usually when I'm on the road and I'm in a hurry and shut up and all of that. Beacons, oh, okay. Feels good. Feels good. But eventually I needed more, you know. Eventually it had to become more a part of my program. So my God today is a friend, and he's a loving God. And I've made amends to the Catholic Church, and they've made amends to me. They've changed a lot. I sponsor a nun. True story. Life got interesting. I got emotionally involved in my first year, and that was it was wonderful because he loved me. I mean, he gave me roses and poetry, and we had a good time for a long time. We got married. My folks came out. It was an AA wedding. It was, you know, in the vows, it was a day at a time till death do you part. And we were both ex-Catholics being married by a Baptist minister, where we had a dance in the hall afterwards. And I was the last one at the party, and I was there. I was there. I was emotionally there. My parents came, and my father didn't believe it. He said, if you ever go think of doing what you were doing before Sharon, I'd think twice. He said, you know, and that's approval out of my dad. That's approval. And finally got it, and you know what? I had a little of my own by then. Because life to me, self-worth that I've earned by working that fourth step. Because, God, Kathy talked about it. I sat and beat everybody's ears for a long time with, how do you do the fourth step? How do you do the fourth step? And finally, I think I hit this woman named Gail too many times with this question. And she said, finger on the chest again. You know, you pick up a pencil and you write it, and I'm sick of you asking me. And I went, okay. And I went home and I started to write this fourth step, which was the hardest thing I had to do up till that time. But you know what? I finished it. And I did my fifth step, and I took my year cake, and for the first time in my life, I finished something like that I started. Really. And that gave me this much self-worth, about an ounce. Well, what our ounces were like. So what happened was I built some self-worth, and those days when you show up at work when it's hard, you know, those are spiritual days to me. When you answer the phone for a 12-step call and you're in the bathtub, you know, or you got tickets somewhere and somebody has to go to a meeting, that's being spiritual. I don't know how else to do it. I don't float around on clouds, you know. I just know that it's just doing what Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do. That's spiritual. That gives me self-worth. That makes that hole in my gut fill up. You know, and when somebody comes along and says, you're not worth it. I think I'll take about 8 ounces of your spiritual self with it. I'd say, this is mine, thank you. I've earned it. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you earn it. You know, I could hand it to you. I could hand you the gift. And if it was that easy to come by, it can go away and come back that easy too. That's my opinion. I earned it. It was hard. It's tough. And on the days that I think, I never drank in Paris either, you know, and I got my passport and I got my getaway card, on those days, I think, I've seen people go out at 5 and 6 years. I've seen people go out at 10 years. And I've seen them come back. And there's something different in their eyes. It's not there anymore. And I watched one man, he's dead now. He died sober. But he had 5, 6 years when I was about 2. And he went out. And he came back. And his eyes were dead for about 5 years before the magic came back. And I got to thank God. What a gift. I've been given that magic. I don't want to abuse it. I don't want to take it for granted. Today I'm okay. Tomorrow I'll deal with tomorrow's problem. Right now we're all okay. Right now. Hello? And that's when we share. That's when we share. It's right now. You know? And that's when we can open our hearts to each other, is right now. So Alcoholics Anonymous and my marriage, and I got busy, and I went to general service, and I did a lot of convention things, and I was just busy, you know. If there was a hostess to be had, I was there, boy. And slowly my sobriety got more full, got more busy. I started to sponsor people. My marriage got a little rocky. We were married. We've been married 8.5 years, and last Tuesday he told me he wants a separation. So that's kind of tough. But I'm feeling pretty strong about it today because of all of you. But things got a little rocky for a while, and I went to Al-Anon. I found that to release doesn't mean to reject. That's what I thought. And I found out what was his problem and what was mine, and I got more involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got more involved in what he was doing at the time, which was kind of the music scene, because I woke up one morning to Billy Idol, you know. I went, oh, hello. And he wore the black hat and I wore the white hat, and but nobody left, and we worked through that. And we went hiking in the High Sierras, and we got rained in at Snake River, and we had to spend 3 days sopping up the corners of the tents. And the only thing you can do is talk to each other, right? And we became friends again, and we renewed our marriage again. And we were married about 6 years then, 7 years then. And what came out of that was I got pregnant. And what came out of that was a beautiful son, Wesley. And I worried about all the acid I took. I worried about all that stuff. But I had to have faith. And I had a beautiful pregnancy and I had a beautiful delivery. And my husband was there every breath. His sponsor was there every breath. One of my babies who lived through 4 children was there. You mean, I will live through this, right? The photographer was there, was in the program. I had 2 other babies sitting out of the door, and the nurse coming in going, I don't know what this means, but the yard just called. I had all my girlfriends doing deep knee bends on the volleyball court. And what came out of that, the nurse walked in once and said, do you want anything for pain? And I said, not yet. And she never came back. So, at 3:33, June 23rd, 84, Wesley was born. And he is a gift from God, because a lot of you probably seen him running around. He's a little over a year and a half old. And he's still got his curls. He's not a girl. Just the back. I left a few. I found out something. I found out that being a mom and being a housewife was enough. I never knew that. I finally found out what was being enough for me. I always thought I had to be a cut, or I had to do something a little more bizarre, or something a little stranger to stand out. And I found out that everything that God has given me in my life was enough. I got real comfortable real fast. and I became a really good mom, and I started to relate to other mothers, normal mothers, and they know about me. You know, these women know where I'm coming from. And they, one of the women, her brother has got 22 days on the program because I was an example. That's all. You know, just an example. I went back to New Orleans to the convention when I was 5 years sober, the international. I was an example. I was an example that the program could work. It was out in the streets that I was back. I stood in front of one of my old roommates for about 3 minutes before she even recognized me. Because I look different, I act different, I've had a psychic change, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, I don't know about spiritual experience either. I know that it comes when I'm working with a newcomer and you're talking to them the same talk for 6 months and they call you up at 11:30 at night after a meeting and they say, guess what my best friend just told me? And you've been beating it in their ears for 6 months. You know? Because you know what? It comes from God. It doesn't come from me. You know? It comes from God. Liz said that. We're channels, you know? And if I can get my crap out of the way, which is working the 12 steps, if my own house is ordered, I can help another alcoholic. Even sometimes by my bad example, I'm sure I'm helping another alcoholic. You know, some of my friends from New Orleans are dead, and some of them are sober today. And that's the result of an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, boy, I think that when I've been given a gift such as sobriety, I like to think of it as something silver, because if you don't shine silver regularly, it will tarnish. And maybe it's a silver goblet, and maybe it's a silver chalice, if you will, and each drop that I put in it is earned self-worth. And gifts from my friends, and gifts from other sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each drop I put in it. And finally, you put drops and drops and drops in this goblet, and one day it overflows. And that happened to me. That happened to me at 6 years sober. It was like the saran wrap finally broke, and the feelings went to my toes. And I became a whole human being. I remember that feeling, and I had to wait 6 years for that feeling. And that's okay. I've had it many, many, many times since. I've had it many times since, because I am part of a link. I'm a link in the chain called Alcoholics Anonymous. I am one people amongst many today trying to stay sober, because our natural state is to be drunk or loaded. We are such miracles. You are a miracle. Look to the person next to you. We are miracles. You know, we are all miracles. Our natural state is to be drunk, laying in the rain, dead, run over, whatever, beat to death, killed. That's our natural state. We have been given a beautiful gift that two men started. You know, what if I was born 80 years ago? Who knows? You know, I go back there, I go back and yesterday I go, and I go into tomorrow, I go into fear. You know, I got to remember that, especially now in my life when things are so kind of precarious. I have to give up my part-time job and my motherhood things I do, and I have to go out and find a full-time job now. Because it's just me and Wesley, you know. I don't know if Al's going to come home. I wish he would, but I don't know if he's going to come home. I can't go on that. I got to go on today. I got to look at life like an adventure, just like this trip up here, just like, you know, okay? You know, we made the first leg. Now somebody lovingly, Mary, gave me a map to look at going home. That's the way it is, you know. Louise, when I met Louise, she just reminds me of my mom so much. I just love her heart so much. You know, and Brady's so one-on-one and intense, I love it, you know. Yeah, you know, we're all individuals here, but we got one program and one way to go. I don't know, you know, I could have gone out with the Krishnas, I could have gone out with the Scientologists, I could have fallen into a cult, I could have fallen and died off that cliff, who knows. But I fell into this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, because I have a loving God, and you have a loving God, you know. And the big blessing is, that I've been taught how to love, you know. Blessed are those few who seek and find love. And blessed are those fewer still who nurture it long enough to give it back. That's the language of the heart. Thank you. I love you. Thank you for having me.